Do we have power to proclaim? Are we praying? And so it kind of goes back. You know, if you don't have this, it's because you probably aren't experiencing this. And if you aren't experiencing this, it's probably because you're not doing this. Okay. Revelation. Similar. And my pen doesn't want to work well. Okay? What we see is the proclamation. Okay? And this assumes the prayer first. Okay? But the focus is going to be on the proclamation. It's not so much about the progress of the gospel, but about the persecution that comes from the gospel. Okay? Because they were experiencing that, and they were going to experience even more of that. And that is supposed to result in perseverance. And, make sure I get it, purification. See, all those preachers, man, they got to alliterate everything. So it's supposed to be, you know, those who persevere are going to be purified. And those who don't, the church is purified because they drop off, essentially. The false professors of Christ drop out, so to speak. And then it ends, as we're seeing, with prosecution. The prosecution of, the persecutors. In other words, judgment. Justice. Vindication. Yeah, well, yeah. I guess I could have put punishment, perdition. Yes. Well, all throughout it, there ought to be praise. Praise is sort of the overarching theme here in all of these things. Yes, it does. A plethora of peas this morning. All right, so as Derek Thomas notes, in the Exodus story, the plague was a direct attack on Pharaoh, who was believed to be an incarnation of the sun god Ra. And so what we find in Exodus is the gods of Egypt who are ruling spiritually Egypt are being judged, not just the people that they rule. And so what we're going to find here is God is going to bring judgment not just on the people that submit to the beast, but we're going to find, not just in this chapter, but even more explicitly in future chapters, the beasts and the dragon themselves will experience judgment. So big idea this morning, and maybe next week, is that God's just judgment will affect all of creation. Let's look at a comparison of the plagues of Egypt, the seven trumpets, and the seven bowls. Okay? I should have put numbers in here, but I didn't. The first plague is the Nile turns to blood, which kills all of life. Okay? It's similar to what we find in the first, second, and third trumpets. Fire, hail, and blood fall upon the earth. One-third of the earth is destroyed. Destruction of the sea, again with blood. One-third of the sea is destroyed. Destruction of the rivers, springs, as a heavenly body falls into the earth. So it's not the blood aspect, but certainly the destruction of the water supply. In the seven bowls, what we're going to find is in the second bowl, the sea is turned to blood and all sea life dies. And in the third bowl, rivers and springs are turned to blood. So, you know, they correspond to the first plague of Egypt. Okay. We find frogs in the second plague of Egypt. There are, I don't think, any frogs in the trumpets, but we're going to find... I didn't put them out there. What a... Oh, yeah, there it is. In the sixth bowl at the bottom there, there is the symbol of frogs, an unclean creature. We're going to get into that. So frogs are prominent, and they are conjured up by the second beast. Okay? So, frogs are used both in the second plague and in the sixth bowl. Gnats, we really don't find gnats. Flies, we don't really find flies. The fifth plague, one-third of the livestock dies. We kind of see that hinted at, so to speak, with the you know, all the water supply dying and all that kind of stuff, or being compromised. Boils on man and beast. I believe there were boils. The sun burning all men. I thought there were boils. Oh, yeah, boils on all who worship the beast. Duh. Thank you, folks. I knew there were boils. I was looking too far down. So, you know, that corresponds again. It's part of this pattern. It's not a wooden sort of pattern where everything is going to be exactly the same, but there's so much correspondence. Hail killing people, animals, and vegetation. Well, that's the first trumpet. And we also see that in... Oh, there was a bowl. Yes, there it is. Hail. The very last word in the last bowl. Thank you. Locusts in the eighth plague. And we have the demons or locusts from the abyss in the fifth trumpet. And we don't actually have any specific locusts, although... Remember, locusts are often also used to represent armies, and, well, we do have a bunch of armies occurring in the sixth bowl. Darkness falls upon the Egyptians, but not the Israelites. We have destruction of the heavenly bodies in the fourth trumpet, as well as, well, just the whole idea of creation crumbling. Darkness falls upon the kingdom of the beast in the fifth bowl, not upon the kingdom of the righteous, so to speak, kingdom of the beast. So, and the one that doesn't have any correspondence as well would be the last one, the death of the firstborn. So you see a lot of correspondence between the plagues of Egypt, the seven trumpets, the seven bowls, and therefore you have a lot of correspondence between the seven trumpets and the seven bowls as well. Okay? So, this idea of patterns. Thunders, seven thunders. There's seals, trumpets, thunders, bowls, in order. Oh. Yes, well, that fits the pattern of Deuteronomy. Let me double check. Sorry, Leviticus 26. Leviticus 26 has four series of seven increasingly severe ordeals due to the idolatry of Israel. Leviticus 26.
Yeah, sorry for the clarification.
That's fine. Well, it's not disconnected from that. Yeah. I mean, the Leviticus 26 is kind of referring to the overall pattern of the judgments. You know, John is following this. There's these four things of increasing destruction that take place. And even within the individual aspects, they're all reflecting Exodus. So, it's not one or the other. It's both and. So,
thank you.
You're welcome. That's helpful to keep in mind. You know, it can easily get, there's a lot of data here, so it can easily get overwhelming. So, clarification is a good thing. All right. Ready for the bowls? Ready or not, here we come. Verse 1. And speaking of frogs, I have one, apparently, in my in my chest. So, sorry about that. Then I heard a loud voice from the temple telling the seven angels, go and pour out on the earth the seven bowls of the wrath of God. So the first angel went and poured out his bowl on the earth, and harmful and painful sores came upon the people who bore the mark of the beast and worshipped its image. Now, one of the other aspects that is connected to Exodus is upon whom different plagues fell. Okay? Some of the early plagues in Exodus fell on everybody who happened to be in the land of Egypt. But then God started to make distinctions between Israel and Egypt. And there were times, there were many plagues where the Egyptians got it and the Israelites didn't. Remember, it was dark over the Egyptians, but not over the Israelites. So God began to distinguish between his people and the Egyptians. And so here we have another one of these distinctions, because this is falling upon those who bore the mark of the beast. It's not falling on those who bear the seal of God. Okay, so John first of all hears the command and the instruction to the seven angels coming from the temple. Coming from the heavenly temple, this judgment is therefore a holy thing. It isn't tainted like our understanding of vengeance. You know, there's a lot of movies that deal with vengeance. It's a popular theme. This is not that. This is just. This is vindication. This is when the law comes down on you, not when you as a private citizen take matters into your own hands kind of thing. And it's holy. It's different really from our experience with justice, which can be tainted. Sometimes the wrong guy goes to jail. Sometimes the right guy doesn't go to jail. So none of that's going to take place. These bowls obviously represent the wrath of God, the sevenfold wrath of God, the complete wrath of God. Those who bear the mark of the beast, who worship the image, they are going to suffer immensely from the plague of sores. These are harmful and painful sores. Not sure exactly what they are, but the point is, no one's going to enjoy this. This will be no mild annoyance. I was going to hold off at the end, but to the end for all of the thingamahoozies. But briefly, guess what you have. From the historicist position, this falls upon the papacy. Yeah. Hey, that's why the new pope only has one lung. I don't know. Robert Fleming predicted this would occur in 1793 through 4 using a day-year scheme beginning with the decree of Justinian in 533, saying it would begin in Italy or France. So they're, all these guys say, hey, this dude, Robert Fleming, called it right. It all works out perfectly with the French Revolution, which resulted in the end of papal power worldwide. So, anyway, the French Revolution would last 5 years, and 2 million people were killed, including 24,000 priests. The power of the papacy in France was shattered. And if you go to France now, I mean, you still see the cathedrals. There's still a few Catholics, but it is a secular nation. They really have nothing to do with God. That's growing, but it is sort of, the government is trying to keep it at bay because they want to maintain a secular state. And they're really trying to ostracize a lot of the influence. And hence you had the riots a few years ago and all that fun kind of stuff. It's a good day for a riot in Europe. Every day is a good day for a riot in Europe, apparently. In the preterists, there's division concerning the recipient of these judgments. Some, mostly the full preterists, like Russell, Stuart Russell, believe it remains on Jerusalem in AD 70. Others, like J. Adams, recognize the shift to Rome as the beast, and who is the second great persecutor of the church. Right. Yes. Which view you take determines who has the mark, apostate Jews or all who reject the gospel worldwide. So if it refers to besieged Jerusalem, such sores would be normal in unsanitary conditions, which is what you'd have if you have a besieged city. So I would say this is, well, I'm not saying anything. The futurists. Ryrie thinks that these plagues happen in quick succession. They are parallel, but more intense than the trumpets. And so he's saying, essentially, that it's not referring to the same time frame, but it's sort of like, you know, again, all of these things are sort of sequential. And that was bad, this is worse, kind of thing. Dispensationalists tend to follow a more literal understanding of the plagues. This would be literal boils on people. Literally huge hail, so forth. Sometimes they're explained by radiation poisoning, like Hal Lindsey, since he's already had like thermonuclear war 15 times. Not sure why anyone's alive yet, or still. These plagues come immediately before the second coming of Christ. For the idealists, the evil world under the beast resembles Pharaoh's oppressive regime. Hendrickson, with others, think that these are parallels. They are parallel to the trumpets, occurring at the same time throughout the time between Jesus' advents. These sores could be incurable ulcers. Some spiritualize them to the corruption of the world breaking out. So you kind of have some people saying, yeah, these can be literal sores. And then some people saying, well, these probably represent something else that's nasty and horrible and so forth. So those are kind of how they handle the sores. But what's clear is it's the judgment of God. Whatever it is, and I think it's actually probably going to be sores, but or was. What's interesting here, I like Dennis Johnson's comment. The beast's mark is useless to shield its servants from coming divine wrath. And come on, remember, they're seeking refuge in the beast, and they're finding that there is none. So, any comments or questions about bowl number one? Yes. Oh, we can't do that. Mm-hmm. Well, at least with this one, you certainly have the unsanitary conditions being sort of a nice petri jar for such things to happen. So. The siege. Yeah, it is. Because, you know, you're trapped in there and you can't bring anything out. So everything stays in, and that creates, well, I guess you could toss it over the wall, but. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. I can understand that question. And it gets back into the nature of this book and how it's using as apocalyptic and prophetic material. There's a high degree of symbolism. And so it can be borrowing the imagery, which was literal in Exodus, and may possibly be adding a layer to it. It's hard to say. Okay. But what is clear that it literally happened in Exodus. You know, we don't want to get all funky on Scripture and start to misinterpret Exodus because of Revelation.
And that's not unrealistic, that it's a spiritual application more than a physical application.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that
whole thing is very much a spiritual. Yes. Yeah, and when we say spiritual, we want to be careful. In that,
it's not real.
Yeah, and in a sense, it's a deeper meaning in reality. We were not freed from physical slavery, but we were enslaved by Satan, and we have been set free. And so sometimes people use that phrase "spiritual application" inappropriately. It's sort of like everything's an allegory. Well, you know, allegorical interpretation has done horrible things to the church in centuries past and present. There's all kinds of.
Because the reality is that Exodus is actually pointing to the spiritual reality.
Yes, preparing people.
That is really.
Yeah. That was looking forward to something. And, you know, if you want to see really bad application of prophecy and spiritualization, Perry Stone on the Tabernacle. If you've never heard of Perry Stone, count yourself a lucky soul. He's one of these guys on TV. And they showed this to us in seminary. It was just hilarious. I think, Pratt showed it. And Perry Stone talks about the tabernacle, and essentially he lays it on America to justify this idea that America is the new temple, essentially, of God. You know, that somehow America is special to God, covenantally. Although I guess he wouldn't use covenantal because he's not a covenantalist, but still. And so you know, people do all kinds of weird, crazy things. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, Christ is a new temple. We're built in Him. So, anyway, enough Perry Stone. We don't need to corrupt you. Bowl number two. Short, sweet, one verse. The second angel poured out his bowl into the sea, and it became like the blood of a corpse, and every living thing died that was in the sea. So now God strikes the sea with a plague like that of blood in the first plague in Egypt. All sea life dies. Not a third like we find, you know, that's the pattern we find with the trumpets. Everything's a third, a third, a third, and now everything's gone. A quarter?
Yeah.
So it kind of it's the heightened aspect of it. Yes, it does. It does. So all sea life dies. And the, you know, part of the point is that man's sin affects all of creation, not just himself. We see that in Romans 8. Creation groans in anticipation because it's been placed under the curse because of Adam's sin. And now it's having, the corporate sin of humanity is having an even greater effect on creation. The old historicists, again, they're applying this to the destruction of the papacy. This is the destruction of the navies that supported the papacy, the navies of France, Spain, and Portugal. And naval warfare, largely with Britain, from 1793 to 1815, well over 1,000 ships were sunk in battle. So, you know, they'd say, oh, this is what, you know, when the Spanish Armada was going up to Britain and the storm came and wiped them out and all that kind of stuff. However, I don't remember all the sea life dying because of the Spanish Armada. there's that little detail that's I think slightly significant in all of this. The preterists The shift from the destruction of Jerusalem to the destruction of the beast explains the greater level of devastation with the bowls. That's how some of them handle it. At least the ones who see that shift. No place in the world is safe in rebellion. Others, like Chilton, and Russell, think this is still dealing with Jerusalem. Either way, it refers most likely to the result of the war on the high seas. Wait a minute. Why did I put that there? Well, and during the Jewish War, Josephus notes in 3:10-9 is the book 3, chapter 10. Right. He notes that several thousand Jews tried to escape via the Sea of Galilee in these tiny boats. So they're kind of under the cover of night, trying to get out of Dodge. And they're noticed, and the Romans send ships after them, and they ended up slaughtering them. And the Sea of Galilee essentially turned red from the blood of these sailors. And the corpses, washing up on the shore of the Sea of Galilee and all this kind of stuff. Not a man escaped from those thousands. The Romans just slaughtered them in the Sea of Galilee. So... you would think, unless he's referring to the destruction of Jerusalem. I don't think he is, but that is a reason why some people gravitate to that. So, still have the frog. Those lousy conjurers. Futurists, some think the seas represent the Gentiles, and that's often a scriptural metaphor, okay? So this would be a plague on the Gentiles or the nations. Others see the seas transformed into a real putrid substance. Ray Stedman perhaps thinks that this is a red tide, which can kill sea life in affected areas, and actually... like right now, there's a lot of manatees that are dying because of red tide down in the Caribbean and Florida. So, which the Caribbeans aren't excited about because they eat the manatees. We think there aren't enough manatees and we save them all, but they eat them in the Caribbean. So, maybe you can get a manatee burger. Just don't call it Barbara. So, Barbara Manatee. Lindsay continues with the nuclear holocaust theme. The seas are poisoned because of the nuclear holocaust. I'm not exactly sure what that has to do with blood, but okay, that's just where he's going with it. The idealists, since the beast arose from the sea, or the nations, most idealists think that this symbolizes all of humanity. Society putrefies, so they, kind of using previously symbolic things and continuing to use them symbolically, okay? society is putrefying. Others think that this points to the sea as an instrument of judgment, with some sea disasters in view. Others that the source of life, food, water, commerce is destroyed. For those of you who remember Soylent Green, the big secret was, the first big secret, the seas were dead. So they were being told that Soylent Green, the food that the government was selling everybody, giving to everybody, they said it was seaweed. But the seas were dead, which led to the next great revelation that Soylent Green is people. So you have Charlton Heston running through the streets, Soylent Green is people, right before he dies, which is a common theme in a Charlton Heston movie. He must die at the end. I think it was in his contract. I must die in the end of 75% of the movies I'm in. So this is taking some of them still take a more literal perspective of it, but some take a more symbolic view. This would be a good one. What do you think? the Titanic. It didn't kill all the sea life, however. That was not really in John's frame of reference. Yes, if you do, something has really gone wrong. The predictions in the 70s would have come true. So, yeah, it's hard to. You have to build a case, essentially, and the case for figurative use here is far stronger than necessarily in the first one, because of the prior use within Revelation of seas symbolically. So you have a much stronger of continuing that same symbolic use. So not saying it's stronger than the other view, but this is stronger than the case for the symbolic use of bowl number one. Okay, to clarify. So these are the things you have to weigh. You know, it's easy to say, well, that's just symbolic. Why? You have to have a reason why. And we see that this was probably used symbolically earlier for the beast coming out of the sea, because there's a prior Old Testament reference a couple of times, not just one obscure reference, to the sea as the nations. Okay, so you build your case. So, how about bowl three? Yeah, I'm really hoping, in a sense, I'm hoping we don't finish today, because I have to go to the Desert Museum tomorrow. That's usually my day to work on this stuff. It's a field trip. It's a school field trip, so to speak. Huh? I have a feeling we won't. But that's because they get longer. Maybe I will. Bowl three. The third angel poured out his bowl into the rivers and springs of water. Okay, so now it's not the seas. It's a distinction is made, and the symbolic argument has to reckon with this as well. Okay, because there is a distinction that's made. And they became blood. And I heard the angel in charge of the waters say, "Just are you, O Holy One, who is and who was, for you brought these judgments. For they have shed the blood of the saints and prophets, and you have given them blood to drink. It is what they deserve." And I heard the altar saying, "Yes, Lord God the Almighty, true and just are your judgments." So this third bowl affects the fresh water supply, rivers and springs. Again, it's blood, or at least looks like blood. An illustration is back in 2011, in August, there was a blood red lake in West Texas. And drought had robbed the lake of oxygen, killing fish and feeding the Chromatocea bacteria. So, what? No, I needed Latin. That's what I needed. Because that's a Latin-looking kind of word. But there was a particular type of bacteria, and all the other life forms died, but this bacteria prospered and had the color red for this lake. So it could be something literally similar to that. You know, so that's if you care about it, I got that from Fox News on their SciTech page. It popped up. I said, "Oh, I can't resist that. I gotta stick that in somewhere, somehow." The angel declares the justness and the righteousness of God from bringing, not permitting, okay, bringing. These are not accidental. They're not sort of like, oh, well, I don't mind if this happens to people. But God bringing these judgments upon humanity, rebellious humanity. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we see that this punishment is appropriate since they spilled the blood of the saints and the prophets. Kind of what unfolded in Pakistan a little over a week ago, as the Muslims burned entire neighborhoods of Christians' homes. They're going to pay for that. God will be just, and there'll be recompense for the ways that those things, like in Africa, how some fundamentalist Islamic wacko groups bomb churches. There'll be judgment for that. They're not going to get away with it. Their government might tolerate such things, but God is not going to tolerate such things. He hears the prayers of his people who have cried out to him for justice, and it will come. And this is part of what we see here in the bowls. It is coming. God's wrath is wise as well as just. Janice Johnson notes this, the gruesome implication is that the persecutors will drink their own blood, an allusion to Isaiah 49:26. Not pleasant. But Doug Kelly, in a longer quote, notes, one of the ways that the Christian church gets deliverance from evil is by praying to God to vindicate the suffering of his people and thus to deal with evil powers. Their going forth, the judgments going forth, is the culmination of the long, agonizing prayers, both of the suffering saints on earth and of triumphant martyrs gathered round the altar in heaven. So both the suffering saints on earth and the martyrs who are in heaven under the altar are both praying for the same thing. And now God is answering that prayer in the bowls. So, any questions before we get to the four usual suspects? Yes, there's lots of data to sort through. And that, that's why this book, in some senses, it's a lot easier to say what it doesn't mean than what it does, because there's so many data points. And that's why you really have to stick to the main theme. Yeah. But we have to keep with the main theme of God preserving his persecuted people. More peace for you. And also, God punishing those persecutors. And that all of this is happening within the sovereignty of God at the proper times. And it is meant to encourage his people to persevere and to pray. So, and to make known the gospel back into your proclaim. It's really meant to drive us to our knees in a lot of ways. That's one of the resounding messages. Praise and prayer by God's people. Despite what's going on. Because of an anticipation of what will come. So. Anything else? All righty. The historicists guess Once again, Napoleon's campaign. As he goes east, he tried to conquer Europe, and he conquered quite a bit of Europe. Significant inroads till he was stopped outside Moscow. Significant rivers in these campaigns, including the Rhine, the Po, and numerous alpine streams in the regions of Piedmont and Lombardy. In those regions, many saints had been killed by the papacy. But see, it sort of twists it. Well, I guess they're saying that the people who killed those saints there, who killed the Lutherans, the Hussites, the Moravians, Waldenses and Huguenots, are now getting their comeuppance at the hands of Napoleon. Yeah, I'm having a hard time with that whole idea of Napoleon as the hand of God. Call me crazy. Maybe. Preterist position. Okay, there's three main ways of looking at this for the preterists. There's a one group that's going to say it's Jerusalem, AD 70. And so they look historically and see that Rome poisoned water sources during the siege of Jerusalem. Okay. For those who believe this is connected to the fall of Rome, there's no corresponding event that we know of at this point. In terms of those who think this refers to the future judgment of God, it's you know, more literal that God brings judgment by contaminating the sources of fresh water, and doesn't necessarily mean it's a catastrophic event. You know, I mean, think of what we're doing to water with pollution in some places. So, futurists, you're thinking literal, aren't you? Some see this as symbolizing the joys of life contaminated by sin. Others see it quite literally. So it just amuses me when the people who talk about literal interpretation go symbolic. Just like, see, you do it too. So it's all right. It's all right. Idealists. The focus is not so much on what the judgment actually is, but its meaning. Okay, so they're saying the point is really the purpose of this judgment, not really nailing down exactly what it is. And the purpose is retribution for the killing of God's people. God does this in response to the cries of the martyrs. So, you know, don't miss the forest trying to figure out the trees, is what they're saying. And there's some wisdom in there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Although with our population, we need food from the sea. But that back then, they could have done well without it, yes. Sorry, I watched one of those TED videos last night, or I watched part of one. Huh? TED Talks? Yeah, one of the TED Talks last night about desertification. And I just got so frustrated, I turned it off. Of a what? Yeah, that could be. It could be. But first they blamed it all on livestock. I said, oh, you know, in the days of Abraham, there was so much livestock that they turned the promised land into a desert. I know. So their whole theory just was, you know, I mean, the Sahara turned into desert, what, 2,000 years ago? 3,000 years ago? So, yeah, it's just, yeah. Anyway, bull number five. Oh, yeah, four. You're right. Yeah, no. I didn't realize I'd did something. And I turned a page. The fourth angel poured out his bowl on the sun, and it was allowed to scorch people with fire. They were scorched by the fierce heat, and they cursed the name of God who had power over these plagues. They did not repent and give him glory. So the sun, a heavenly body, is the object of the fourth bowl of wrath. So the consequence of sin is not limited to this planet, but creation extends beyond it to encompass the sun and more, obviously. Instead of it being extinguished, it grows in intensity, burning humanity. So these are like hyper sunspots. Really bad sunburn. Yeah, I mean, this would be like as if what they were threatening with the fluorocarbons would happen. You know, the hole in the ozone opened up so wide that the harmful rays were not kept out, and people are suffering greatly. So it's kind of that times two or whatever. Some might say, but this comes from the sun, and the global warming people try desperately to disregard sunspot activity as a cause of global warming. Even though the graphs line up really nicely. So yes, I am one of the people who thinks that there is a high, it's not only correlation with the sunspots, but there's causation with the sunspots with regard to global warming. That's correct. No, it's not oversimplified. It's about money and power, as it often is. Yeah, money, power, and control. So, climate is dynamic. I mean, if you just look at history, it's dynamic. And if you look even in history 40 years ago, for those of us who are old enough to remember, Time magazine, here comes the next ice age. You saw it in movies. I remember a couple of them, you know, where... Well, these are more B movies, but it was a coming ice age. It was the world had frozen over, and you know all that kind of stuff. And one of them was actually like a James Coburn murder thing, but the world had kind of frozen over. And we have radical changes in climate prior to the Industrial Revolution. So what makes us say that this time it's all about man? So it's that hubris, I think. Yes, you can get funding to say it. And it, governments do like to capitalize on things to, for their own benefit. So, all kinds of governments do that. Anyway, either here or necessarily there. Instead of being extinguished, burns, creation is essentially unraveling as a part of this of the judgment. And we're going to see that continuing, that theme continuing. like the beast that they worship, the people blaspheme God for his just judgments. Okay? Remember? The horn in Daniel was speaking blasphemy. When we see the beasts, the blasphemous horns that they have, and they begin to speak blasphemy against God. And now we see that what is revealed in the hearts of these people as they're suffering judgment is they begin to blaspheme God. They're, instead of repenting, they're even more hardened in their sin and resisting God. So they refuse to repent. under these judgments of God. And so, you know, now that's the one of the early signs of this kind of thing taking place, the hardness of heart, which is again one of the patterns in Exodus. I don't have it up there. What did Pharaoh keep doing? Yeah, I'll let you free when this plague gets lifted, and as soon as the plague gets lifted, he doesn't set them free. And so, you know, he continually hardens his heart under the sovereignty of God. Yeah, he's like, wait a minute, what did I do? Let's go get him. And it led to his ultimate destruction. So they're hardened in their sin. They're still continuing to raise that fist against God. How dare you do this to us? It's like, well, yeah, you're sinners. what do you expect a just and holy God to do? Pat you on the back and give you $5,000? Yes, and he's going to bring the peace the hard way. He's going to love his people. We got more on that in the sermon today. So the historicists tend to say that the sun serves as a symbol for a prominent leader, perhaps Napoleon, who devastated Europe. So now we're really talking symbolism, baby. But again, as Christopher notes repeatedly, this is a very Eurocentric understanding of the book of Revelation. Okay? Correct. Yes, a lot of futurists. It's very America, the West, centric. For the radical preterists, it's all, centered in Jerusalem. So, different people, different agendas. Preterist position. There is no record of such an event in either the fall of Jerusalem or Rome. This passage could point to oppressive tyranny exercised by zealous sects. Not sure, you know, they're doing sort of, huh? Yeah. Chilton, who thinks this refers to Jerusalem, sees this as a reversal of the covenant blessing of protection from the heat of the day by God. It's referred to in Psalm 91 and Psalm 121. Yeah. And that this was promised in Deuteronomy 28:22. Not sure how that applied to Jerusalem, but nonetheless, he actually builds a good case for it to take place, but there's no record of it taking place at the fall of Jerusalem. So he does some good theology, but not very good application of the theology. Huh? Josephus lived. He wrote all about it. It faded in the sun, is what you're saying? Okay. Well, that was before. Could be. Possibly. All right, futurists, because we're going to wrap this up in 2 minutes here. We'll continue after we finish the fourth bowl. This is the opposite of the fourth trumpet. Extreme heat. Oh, wait, what was the fourth trumpet? Oh, okay. So it's not necessarily dark, which the focus there was not cold, but darkness. But here the focus is on heat, not excessive light. So I'm not really, there's a correspondence there, but they're making the wrong points of contact. Some take this symbolically, so that the government begins to torture those under their dominion. Well, they've been torturing the people of God for a while, but now they're torturing their own people because it falls on those who have the mark of the beast. Others see this as God's great blessings turning into great curses and suffering, similar to what Chilton talks about. Some take it more literally, solar flares exacerbated by a depleted ozone layer. Okay, you can tell that was written in the 70s, because that was in the all the ozone stuff, 70s and 80s. Lindsay sticks with the nuclear holocaust theme. It's good that that someone's consistent. The historicists and Hal Lindsay, they're consistent. Given the proclivity of certain individuals and the writing of books, always updating it based on what's happening today. You know, every time there's a war in the Middle East, John Walford, you know, revamps his book, changes a few names, you know, and there's a new book. I'm sure someone's going to do this with the whole global warming thing. It's just inevitable. I'm surprised it hasn't happened yet. And lastly, the idealists. There are no detailed attempts are made to explain how the fulfillment will take place. or you know, it just sort of, God's going to make the sun really hot. And I don't know if that's like the sun is flaring out and, you know, not quite a supernova, but something similar on a much smaller scale, but enough to radically change the environment on Earth such that, but the problem is, the people who were scorched, again, it's one group of people. And unless the people of God aren't there, how does this happen? Okay? Apart from, you know, obviously God's power to be able to do that, but it would be difficult for us to explain how he does that.